case of the day, the United States versus Carter. Mr. McGowan.
May it please the Court. Andrew McGowan for the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Morris Carter. We've raised four issues in this appeal based on a conviction of a Hobbs Act extortion case. Unless the Court has any questions about whether Mr. Carter was acting as a recorder of deeds for these three convictions or the sentencing, I intend to address the other two issues.
Well, I did have as to the color of official right. Didn't Mr. Carter's own words give the impression that he was used? As to the if you take the tax lists, for example, Mr. Carter seems to have told Mr. Levis unequivocally that these were lists that were not available to the public and that he obtained them by way of a special.
He did say that. My argument in that specific instance is, of course, that those lists weren't created by his office. And when you take the context Mr. Levis's demanding those lists, he got them. First of all, he got the tax list. He looked at it, and he said, well, I really wanted the commissioner's list. So he got the commissioner's list. He looked at it, and then just forgot about it completely. The thing that this Court needs to look at to see whether he was acting under color of right includes, to some extent, what he says. But I believe it's more of a reasonable person. Would a reasonable person believe that he was acting as recorder of deeds? Now, his statement implied that he had some sort of special connection with some woman in some other department. I mean, he told the person it was another department. And, I mean, he did say that, but I just don't think that because it's from another department that it was reasonable for the person to believe. Of course, Mr. Levis didn't believe it at all. He was working for the government, and he was just trying to set my client up. But a reasonable person, even under those circumstances where he's saying, oh, yeah, I can get this because I have some sort of special connection with some other agency, that establishes the color of right. I understand, of course, the color of right argument for him filing something in his own office is a little weaker for that very reason. Does that answer your question? The interstate commerce argument in this case was that the actions depleted Mr. Levis's assets. And, of course, the government doesn't have to prove much to establish an effect on interstate commerce. I recognize that. But I believe under the facts of this case, the government didn't quite meet its burden. And there are two problems. First, Mr. Levis was paying cash, and he specifically said that he didn't want them tied to his businesses. So we don't have any evidence of what of his three businesses these would have been from. The other problem is that even if the money, if they established the money was from the businesses, there's not enough evidence to establish that the businesses themselves were involved in interstate commerce. And I say that knowing that, of course, the government put on the paint seller who said that Mr. Levis had a contract with him. But that evidence was interesting in what it didn't have. There was no specific instance of any sale. I mean, we don't know if he bought a can of paint from the business when it started out, or if he didn't start up buy a can of paint from the business.
Well, don't we know that Mr. Levis buy that the company, the construction company, purchased materials from the paint company, which we know received its paints from Ohio.
Yes.
Why would you need additional proof beyond that, Mr. Lee, on that point?
Well, what I was looking for in particular was some evidence of a particular one sale, just one sale. What he testified was he had three companies, and they were involved in rehabbing houses. Now, we know from the evidence that he didn't rehab houses all his professional career. In fact, recently he'd been running a restaurant. That's, I believe, where the bankruptcy came from. He was also a real estate agent, which is where the lien came from. I mean, this is a man who says he does a lot of work. But we didn't have any evidence that he actually bought paint, and that's my argument. I mean, he said he did, but he didn't say, you know, well, I bought a couple of cans the day before. He didn't say, well, I bought a whole bunch of paint a year or two before that I use now. I mean, we don't have any evidence. And under the effect on interstate commerce, it really does matter when he last purchased an item. If he purchased it within 6 months or a year, that would be probably okay. But if it were like 2 years before, that might not satisfy it. If under the test that this court has proposed over the cases. I would add that the government also argued that there was a house in New York. However, the specific evidence in that case was that he subbed the business, the work out. We don't, again, have any tie to any particular business, not simply because he was paying in cash, but he didn't say, well, this is part of one business or another business. He just said he had this building, this house in New York. And the other problem in this particular argument is that one of the items that he paid for was for an individual benefit. The lien on the house, that was Mr. Leavis's personal property. And the case law does distinguish between payments made by individuals as opposed to payments made by businesses or for business purposes. And I believe that the government's argument that if he had the lien taken care of, he would be able to refinance the house and would have more money for his business is a little too removed, even under this standard. The other argument that I'd like to address is the improper questioning. The government admits that the questioning in this case was improper. During Mr. Carter's cross-examination, the government asked witness by witness.
Yeah, but wasn't it really in response to questions that had been drawn out on direct examination?
Actually, the government's argument is that Mr. Carter answered a question in that way.
On direct.
Right, but the question itself wasn't
didn't invite that. Okay.
Mr. Carter to answer that way. He just answered that way. And
he maintained in response to a question that didn't solicit that sort of response that the other witnesses were lying.
I believe it was one witness at the time, and it might have been for a specific event. I'm not
well, no,
exactly.
I mean, he said that all these witnesses had lied. I mean, he was saying that one was lying, that one was lying, that one was lying.
Well, that was in response to the government's series of questions.
Oh, I see what
you mean. The individual person. And in fact, the fact that the government drew it out is kind of interesting, too. But the invited error doctrine is kind of an interesting argument for the government to make in this case. Of course, they didn't object at the time if they thought Mr. Carter's answer was incorrect. I don't know if it's actually incorrect. The questioning is what's incorrect. And it's, of course, eliciting that kind of answer, but it's the question is incorrect. But if the government thought it was incorrect, they had the chance and the opportunity to object. The only time we see the argument that it was invited was before this court. Of course, in the district court overruled the objection, so the government didn't really have to say much.
What was the harm, even accepting the concession that this was error?
The harm in this case was that Mr. Carter testified. Whenever a defendant testifies in a trial, his credibility is the most important thing. And what this kind of questioning does is it destroys the witness's credibility. Mr. Carter's testimony actually was not that different from most of these witnesses. And his problems with them, as elicited through cross-examination, through direct examination, with their statements, really kind of minor. But the way the question's asked, it's a taunting. It's, oh, so, Allison's lying, right? Yes. My other witness is lying, right? All the government witnesses are lying, right? It's to provoke the defendant. And, of course, the motive is okay. You can provoke a defendant who's testifying, but the questions are improper. And in this case, we actually have some evidence of the results of this. I mean, the consequences sort of mirror the changing of the burden of proof. The judge in this case commented after the trial, he looked at the evidence and he thought, you know, to believe you, Mr. Carter, I would have to disbelieve all of the government witnesses. Now, without that line of questioning, of course the judge could have reached that conclusion himself. But that's not the kind of problem that this case presented evidence-wise. We had the government witnesses said one thing, and Mr. Carter said another thing. And it was basically the difference was why the payments were being made, which was the crux of the whole case. And I'd point specifically to the government's argument that the $1,000 was for those two lists. Mr. Carter's testimony was that their first meeting, which was not recorded, was about Mr. Leavis giving him a laundry list of things to do, and Mr. Carter saying, sure, I'll do that for about $2,000. Many of those things, showing properties, you know, introducing people to, for instance, he wrote a letter of introduction to the mayor, those aren't illegal. The government didn't contend they were. And by the time Mr. Carter got that $1,000, he had performed, he estimated, about 20 hours of work for Mr. Leavis, not including getting the lists. So the jury had this question before them. Well, what was that agreement? What was that original agreement? It's not in writing. There's no statute. Was it that he do all of this work for $2,000, or was it, you know, piecemeal, $1,000 for these two lists? I can get these two lists for you because I know a woman in some other agency. And that's the harm in this case, those kinds of questions. It helps destroy the witness's credibility before the jury improperly. Unless there are any questions.
You want to say anything about the sentencing?
Yeah. Sure, the sentencing. The problem with the sentencing is that the district court seemed to rely entirely on the guidelines as if they were mandatory. I mean, I've made another argument, but that's essentially the problem in this case. And, of course, that comes out in various ways. I mean, I've never seen a record where a district court said that Congress, through AIDS, was threatening not only this judge, but the whole judiciary with the ability to sentence people. That seemed extraordinary to me. But you tie that in with the judges asking counsel time after time, well, do you have a case that supports this argument that you're making for a lower sentence? Counsel said, well, there's Booker. And the judge said, yeah, but Booker's not enough. Unfortunately for the judge and for Mr. Carter, Booker is enough. And even the judge's argument saying, well, if I'd agreed with your sentencing argument, you know, for a two-level reduction, I would have still sentenced you the same sentence. Still tied to the guidelines, he said. That's still within the guideline range. So for all of these reasons, I think that the sentencing was incorrect in this case and should be remanded for that.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Mr. Radcliffe?
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Assistant United States Attorney Tom Radcliffe. I represent the government.
Could we go right to the sentencing?
Yes.
You know, when you look at Judge Lozano's remarks, I get the distinct impression that he was reluctant even to consider a non-guidelines sentence. He did acknowledge that the guidelines are advisory. He did do that. But his remarks seem to suggest that he considered the guidelines range to be presumptively reasonable, which, of course, he wasn't. Can you address my concern?
Absolutely. I think that Judge Lozano was doing what he often does, which is he has a disdain for gut law. And what he was trying to do in saying, I want some authority for this kind of departure that you're asking me for, I want to see if you have case law, the back and forth that goes on for maybe 10 pages in the transcript, Judge Lozano was simply trying to determine whether this request was frivolous or not frivolous.
Well,
whether
of course, phrase it in terms of departure analysis is a legal mistake, isn't it? I mean, since that's not required anymore?
It is. It's the kind of nomenclature that this court has recognized that district court judges are tied to in some ways out of habit over the past 20 years. Certainly, what Judge Lozano was looking for, though, was a basis to determine whether there was any basis in the law for this rather remarkable request on the part of the defendant, which was, you know what, I may be a corrupt public official, I may stand here having been convicted, but you know what, I want credit. I want time off my sentence because of all those years that I did serve the public and certainly didn't rip anybody off. That's the argument. Judge Lozano was saying, where is your authority for that?
There isn't a requirement of any of that's the whole problem.
That's the point.
But, Your Honors, my point is that because of this court's decision in U.S. v. Miranda from last October, a panel on which you, Judge Flom, sat and Judge Rovner, you wrote the opinion, the key issue there is whether the request or whether the argument is frivolous or not frivolous. And to determine whether something is frivolous or not frivolous, you have to know whether there is any recognized legal merit to it, as the court said.
This is apples and oranges. Look, Judge Lozano expressed wariness of sentencing below the guidelines for fear that Congress will eventually impose statutory constraints on the district court sentencing discretion. And that's not a legitimate reason to overrule individual defendant's argument for below. There's a disconnect. There's just a disconnect in this. What was this? Remind me, was it 24 months?
The sentence was 51 months, Your Honor.
Oh, 51 months.
And Judge Lozano, in fact, said, whether I've given you, I'm sorry, with respect to a different departure or a different reason for a lower sentence within the guideline range or even for a non-guideline sentence, with respect to a different issue, whether the defendant was a leader or organizer, the judge ended up saying, look, even if I had given you credit for that, I still would have given you a 51-month sentence. Yes, it's in both guideline ranges, and he did say that, but what he went on to say is, because I feel that a 51-month sentence is appropriate in this case. It's appropriate because you show no remorse. It's appropriate because you were abusing your office. It's appropriate because I need to deter other people like you, other elected officials, from engaging in this kind of contemptuous behavior here. And keeping their hand, putting their hand in the till while they're on the public's on the clock for the public, so to speak. So the judge is not just saying. I realize he does say that he had been to a conference and congressional staffers had told him, well, if there are all these departures or all these non-guideline sentences given, we may end up going back to a different sentencing regime post Booker, but. That doesn't, in the end, mean that Judge Lozano was unwilling to consider the non-frivolous arguments. He did consider the non-frivolous arguments. He did do what this court and other courts have said is necessary in the post-Booker era, which is look at the guidelines, apply them, determine if they are reasonable in this sentence for this particular defendant, and then go on to give the sentence that they think is appropriate. And I think that the distraction here is just the back and forth about the judge saying, well, I'm not going to consider your request for a non-guideline sentence unless you have authority. I don't think that means that the judge is indicating that he is locked into those guidelines. I think what it means is he's trying to figure out, is this the kind of argument that I really have to give merit to? Is this the kind of argument that is that there's a recognized legal merit for? I mean, the test that this court set in Miranda for a non-frivolous versus a frivolous argument is, would someone who did not know anything about the facts, without being told about the facts of the case, would they understand why the judge did not accept a certain argument or accept a request for a non-guideline sentence if they knew nothing about the case? And I think that the request that the defendant was making in this case is exactly one of those. It is that rather bold request, as I described before, to get credit for the time that the defendant was a public servant, allegedly not a corrupt public servant at that time, but to get credit in a case where he stands convicted of actually abusing his office. That kind of a request is a frivolous request, and therefore no case law was needed for the judge to, or the judge wanted to know whether there was case law, and because there was none, he didn't have to address it at all.
Well, Mr. Ratcliffe, is your argument then that in every case where there's an abuse of office and a conviction,
I believe it would be frivolous to advance that kind of a departure argument.
What do you mean by that kind?
Well,
that I was a good servant for two terms, but I did this That's frivolous.
Correct. Correct.
As a matter of law, that's pretty extraordinary.
Well,
you might want to pull back from that.
Yeah. Your Honors, my position on this is informed by the research that was done in this case, in which we didn't find that was an argument that has ever flown or that has ever received treatment.
Well, those arguments are always made in public corruption cases, and before, we only now are seeing the play out of that in the post-Booker era.
Yeah.
That's fair, Your Honor. That's fair, certainly. Okay.
So let's go on to the why the government didn't put on evidence that B&L Construction had actually purchased paint from IC Paint, for example, in order, to confirm the probable effect on interstate.
Well, I think, Judge Rovner, there are a couple responses on that. Certainly, the evidence that B&L or that Mr. Levis's business was involved here in this scheme is clear from the record, in that the $50 check that was written to get the contracting license in this case was a check written on B&L's account. Certainly, B&L was the company that Mr. Levis was using, was his rehabbing business that we know was active and engaged. And with respect to the arguments earlier regarding the paint and why there was not more evidence regarding the paint, well, we know that Mr. Levis, the government's informant, was, as I said, actively engaged in rehabbing homes. We know that in part because one of these meetings with the government's informant and the defendant took place in one of the homes that was being rehabbed. We do know that then a person from the paint company came in and testified that, yes, in fact, Mr. Levis, the informant, does have an account, does purchase paint. Now, with respect to whether there is, as Mr. McGowan said, is there a temporal requirement here? Do we have to show that paint was purchased within 6 months or within a year? I don't see that. I'm not aware of one. But it stands to reason in this case, because Mr. Levis was actively engaged in this ongoing business of rehabbing homes, that certainly within a reasonable amount of time, especially because he did have a house that was being rehabbed during the events of this case in the summer of 2004, that paint was purchased. But beyond that, regarding the effect on interstate commerce, there is also evidence in the record, and you heard Mr. McGowan refer to it, that Mr. Levis was directly engaged in interstate commerce by having built a model home, by being in the process of building a model home in the state of New York. He, in fact, flew there during the course of this case, before and after, before one of the meetings with the defendant. So, and Mr. McGowan's argument that, well, there was no evidence in the record about whether Mr. Levis was using a subcontractor, I think that is irrelevant. The test is not whether Mr. Levis was personally engaged in this business in New York, in this model home, but whether he and his company were engaged in that. And the evidence is clear on that. The record is clear that he certainly was involved in interstate commerce, not just B&L and their rehabbing business, but the direct effect on interstate commerce, the direct involvement through building this home and flying to New York. Seeing no further questions, I'll sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ratcliffe. Mr. McGowan, we have a couple of minutes. Thank you, Mr. McGowan, and thanks to the Defender Service for the representation. Mr. Ratcliffe, thank you. Case is taken under advisement.